This is an oral history interview being conducted over the telephone long distance with Dr. Alfred G. Chaillon, MD, who is the donor of the Rio Grande Southern Railroad Records Collection at the Center of Southwest Studies. The interview is being conducted on Thursday morning, November 21st, 1996. I'm in my office in Reed Library, and Dr. Chaillon is in Moreton, Illinois. The interviewer is Todd Ellison, representing the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College, Durango, Colorado. Good morning, Dr. Chaillon. How are you? I guess we did. We got as much as we needed down here, so we thought, oh. Well, I was born in Elmhurst, outside Chicago. Uh-huh. Well, and my parents left before I turned one because they couldn't stand the summers and the winters. So anyway. But is this going to be a good time to interview you about your donation of the collection and about about the railroad? Would that be good? Oh, but you might be able to tell us some stories about the collection and about the railroad, I bet. So, huh. Yeah, I'm not sure if we have that, but mostly what I'd like to ask you about is the how you got interested in Durango and in the railroads and how you came to be able to give the collection to the Center of Southwest Studies. Okay.
My retirement number is 710, which is the railroad retirement. That's my Social Security number. 710.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, I was started in on the railroad too, very young. And I left high school, graduated high school, and went the same day to the railroad shops in Aurora, Illinois, Burlington Shops there. Got a job there, so then that put me in right out of high school. And up until this day, of course, I still bear that same number, that my Social Security number. And off every summer, even when I was in medical school, I would take and I'd have some kind of a job someplace on the railroad. Maybe it was a rip track or maybe it might be out in like one of them when the Zephyrs first came in. Why, we used to do what they call mo-docking there. They had fiber brushes with long arms on them, and we used to use oxalic acid every trip they'd come in to get all of the oil and everything off of those coaches into Chicago. So, in other words, my life has been tied up with the railroad all the time, and I did that until I went into my internship in medical school, after medical school.
Huh, that's good. So, how did you transfer that interest over to the Colorado side of the railroads?
Graduation. I was able to get, my father was able to get a pass, which would be the last one they could get for me because I left high school. And, Dad got a pass to come to, Colorado on that, and we, left Aurora there and went to Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and then went around on the narrow gauge all the way through there, down to Ouray and up along, going to Buena Vista and places like that. We took all that narrow gauge stuff along there. Well, of course, I got interested in the mountains and the railroads, and as soon as I was able financially to get back there, I used to come there every year. And that was my railroad thing. Of course, once you get into railroad, one railroad nut knows how to talk to another railroad nut, you know.
Yeah.
And so you make friends very, very easily.
Yeah. Huh. Now, how did you get from Glenwood Springs to, was it Montrose that the...
And then went from Montrose. Let me see. Went to Montrose through the See, there's my memory. Oh, anyway, we're down in the floor of the canyon. There, that's all underwater now.
Uh huh.
There, the river has filled it up. Anyway, all the way back up to Buena Vista.
Huh.
And I made that then, of course, every year. Then I used to come, or every other year that I could afford it. I used to come down and jump back into these individuals, and I got acquainted with them. Some of them were not a whole lot older than I was.
Huh.
And I forget what they used to call that darn thing, that round, not around the horn. I've been trying to go through some of this stuff here, but I don't know if I can help you there or not.
So how would you have been, would that have been in the 20s, 1920s, when you first came, when was that? Because you're
32.
Okay.
In 1932, and so my first time that was there was 1932. And then when I think it was about, probably 35 or 36 when I got back there and started coming on my own as often as I could get out there. I finally bought a home out there in 1950, probably 1951, 52, I'm guessing. And I used to go out there during the month of July every year up until I took a job as the medical director for Caterpillar.
Huh.
And that was 1967. It was when I went with Caterpillar.
And where was that home?
Up and up outside of
But it was it near Durango? Oh.
It was up there in, not too far from Denver, out about the second batch of mountains out there.
Uh-huh.
And I can't, it was in the, it was the county, a county seat was where Coors Beer is.
Oh, down by Golden. Yeah, Golden.
That's right. And so I had that from about 1955, just picking up until around 1970. And oh. After 1970, I just gave it all up.
Huh.
There, and I didn't really go out there an awful lot. Now, another thing that brought me out there is continuing medical education. They used to have good sessions the second week in February at University of Illinois, University of Colorado there in Denver, the medical school. And I used to attend that. That used to be just ritual. I go there in February and up to Rochester, New York, or Rochester, Minnesota, in the first week of April. And that was I used that for my continuing medical education.
Huh. What? Uh-huh. Well, then if we could talk about the demise of the Rio Grande Southern Railroad in Ridgeway and how you came to find out about the records there. I think that was in about 1952 or so. That's what your son said.
First of all, one railroader kind of smells another railroader out. They have the same odor, I think. That's because I got acquainted with a couple of the conductors on the on the Rio Grande Southern, there from just nosing around, and finally when we'd taken hike trips, in other words, we'd get acquainted, and so they'd put us in the caboose. I'd put me in the caboose, and I even took my wife out there one time, and we went and took a nice trip around through there, and then I met, there was case of George McLean was one, and the other fellow was one of the senior conductors, a heck of a nice guy. I can't think remember his name. In fact, we were very, very friendly. We used to stop at their home many times when we were out there during the week or 2 weeks of the summer. Huh. Acquainted with what was going on there. And then the postmaster at Ridgeway, I used to go out there in February. I would always stay in a motel in Ridgeway, and he'd pick me up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and his wife used to make a breakfast for 25 people, you know, and there'd be just he and I there. And I used to use a lot of their equipment. They had old beat-up trucks, but they were nice to get around in the hills on. And that was one of the things that kept me going out there, because I always had a place to go there in July and in February.
Now, why in February? That's, isn't it?
It's because I would be out there to the medical school in Denver,
uh-huh.
And that would be that first week. So then I would take, I would leave Friday night and go, and I would stay until Wednesday, drive over to Ridgeway and stay at Ridgeway until leaving maybe the following Wednesday or Thursday.
Huh.
I'd add that time because I was already out there on the other side of the hill. And I used to take these railroaders to eat. At that time, you could buy a pretty good size lunch for 35 cents back there. And huh. You know, with railroaders, you never listen to one of them when he's by himself, because they fib. They tell stories that are big, but when you get them all together, they kind of watch what they say. And so that was one of the things that I was interested in. And I had experience with, my dad was a railroader, and I know with his friends, all they ever talked about was railroads, no matter when you went there, you know. And that was one of the reasons that I got where I knew the railroad pretty personally. And I used to be able just to, when I'd go out there, I'd just step on that caboose, and nobody ever complained a bit. And I'd sometimes be gone a couple of days.
Can you describe what it felt like or what it looked like to when you were riding on that caboose in those days?
The whole world just opened up to you, because you were coming up, and particularly when you went over Lizard Head Pass, and you looked and you saw a big section of the world behind you. And of course, the Lizard Head, the peak there, which is now gone, which has finally completely fallen, that used to be quite a thing to see. That it looked like a big finger sticking up in the air there. And there were a couple times when I just missed. The Almighty was with me on those trips. Because in wintertime and even in the summer, you could have, with summer, of course, there was washouts and things of that type. But I know one time I left, and 10 days later, they were still snowbound out there. And they're dropping stuff by air for the railroad crew. But luckily, I had made about 7 or 8 trips where they had, even the very last one that I took off there, we jumped off and got a ride back so I could get back home. And they were stuck, I think, 2 days or 3 days on that one because the locomotive broke down. And they didn't really get that out until next spring, because that was, I think, the very last trip. In fact, I'm sure that the railroad ran.
Huh. How would they clear the snow off the track in those days?
They had one of these blowers that looked like a freight car, and it had this tremendous wheel on the front. But that had got into an explosion, blew up, and that was the end. And after that, that they put on the front of the locomotives, that shield that they'd put on there, you know, that would scoop it out to the side as they'd go along. And of course, with that, they spent a lot of time.
What was the problem with the tracks?
Tracks, the whole thing is that, first of all, it was the weather changes. And the second thing is that because they were in and out of bankruptcy so often, the only thing that they got was used stuff. That was what the DNRG would get something like, and you could take it up and replace it like the Denver and Rio, or the Rio Grande Southern would get it. And really, to get anything new, they never did. In fact, they tried this famous spike, the two-headed spike, the only place it was in the world to use it. And it was on 20-pound rail, which is, 20-pound rail, I don't think I could run my automobile on it. It was all hand-me-down. That's the whole thing. Locomotives and everything.
What was the problem with their finances? Why'd they always have such trouble with them?
Well, first thing is, of course, they were really subservient to the Denver and Rio Grande. And that's like having a relative that you're keeping, and you're just going to give them enough to get by. That's just about what was the story all the way along. Because they were always fighting City Hall, always trying to fight to get that last dime. And that was a problem that they had there. And, of course, with the upkeep, once you get the glorious amount of junk here for rails and stuff, the upkeep on it is terrific, because it doesn't take much for those things to go off that little rail, you know. So These fellas were experts at putting them back on there, but with the wrecks and mishaps and everything else that they had, plus the secondary or tertiary degree of repairing of the locomotives and so forth. They were just running, always running with second-hand equipment all the way along. That was a problem.
So tell me about the last. So the Rio Grande Southern ended in about the 50s or the 50s. What can you remember anything about the last days of it? And, yeah.
Yes, because I was there. I was there when they pulled the first rail. When was it? I forget the date on that. Anyway, I was out there with my son, the son that lives out there in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
He was with me out there when they pulled the first rails. Of course, they relied on these geese there for their transportation and for small, like the milk cans and things of that type, there for the past, or for the last, I would say probably 8 to 10 years. Then, of course, they ran the passenger business with those buses. First, the first ones they built were built from Pierce Arrow automobiles. I don't know if you remember them or not.
Uh-huh.
That's what the first buses were made out of, and they hauled the passengers on, and they used to take all the way from 5 to 10 passengers on those, and then they'd haul all their freight in that big box on the back. And all they did, of course, they finally got it down to an art with those geese. They were kind of nice, but there again, with the problem with the trackage and all that stuff, the only thing is they were easier to get back on the track when they have to slip off. And the war, of course, is one of the things that prolonged their life, because they had a lot of, all of the scrap pile over there near, what is the name of that place? It used to be the U.S. Vanadium Corporation used to have mines where they mined vanadium. And they used to throw away a material that was of use to nobody, and it was called uranium. And so when the war started, before the war started, they were back there reworking those vanadium mines. And, of course, the Rio Grande Southern began hauling that stuff to both ends of the line. Most of it went down to Durango, I understand. finally got where it just couldn't even pay for itself. And the trackage was all shot. And of course, they got into a couple of fires down there from sparks from a locomotive. And I think that was down in the southern half someplace. And they got into a financial fine down there, which took away a little spare change that they didn't have to continue operating. So any kind of a hard luck that you can even think up on a railroad, they had it all the way from the 90s up until the day that they shut the railroad down.
Huh. While we are on the topic of the Galloping Goose, did you ever ride on one?
I rode on one of them. They were just nothing more than a bus. And when I went on one there, we had a woman get on there in India. She got on and she had a little lamb, but she had it up in her arms and it looked like a baby. You know, had it all wrapped up. She wasn't supposed to be carrying stuff in there on the front of the thing. That belongs in the back. But she made the trip all the way, just about probably 8 miles or 10 miles along from a pickup. They picked her up at one of those stations and took her to the next one. So this conductor or operator was on there. He said, I knew she had something, but I didn't. I just forgot about it. I knew she wasn't going to go very far.
Huh.
They were just, they're nothing more than just a bus. That's all. Were homemade buses. They're pretty slick, but the first ones were pretty crude.
Huh. How did their speed compare with the speed of the train? How fast those buses could go?
The buses would run, and they were in the 20s, 20, 25, 27, 28, that's about. They never went a whole lot more than that, because the whole thing is that you have a brake problem with them if you get a pretty good sized load on them. And that was, railroad was up and downhill all the way. And so they limited the amount of stuff that they used to carry. That was one of the reasons why they didn't. In other words, if they could have hooked a little outfit on the back end that would carry a few tons, well, they probably could handle it. But it's all right. They could get uphill, but going downhill is a big problem. Because once they get something behind that pushing thing, it'd come to those curves. Instead of making the curve, it would go all straight. That was a problem with the locomotive. On their axle, they had a lot of wrecks. Your grandfather did. I believe there any book that you picked up has got pictures of wrecks.
Huh. Now, if we get back to talking about the records, when was it that you heard about the records were? Your son told me that you heard that the records were about to be taken to the dump.
I can't recall the time, but I had met on. Was halfway friendly with Ed Rando, R-A-N-D-O-W. In fact, in that book of Josie Crumb's, I took a picture of him nailing up the sign about the railroad going under, which is in the back of the book, back part of the book. I got to be acquainted with him, and I used to stop there and visit with him, chat with him when he was on. And he was getting things all lined up. See, they sold locomotives. And a lot of locomotive repair and replacement parts to Knott's Ferry Farm. And so Ed Rando is the one that was getting all of that stuff lined up. In fact, he went out there when they first shipped all of that stuff out there. He went out to Knott's Ferry Farm. And they had a tremendous amount of equipment and stuff for the locomotive. And, of course, they're still operating out there, the locomotive. And we would go to lunch, and I'd sit around and shoot the bull and so forth. And this one time, we just got off. I don't know how the subject came up, but I said to him, "How are things going?" Well, he said, "Now it's all done. He said, "We're pulling the shades down now." I said, "We've had some bickering here about records and stuff." He said, "We put, I think he said there was two
because there was no need for them in anything else. And so they were trying to make up their mind what to do. Well, apparently this Richardson was one that had his fingers in the thing. And so I said to him, well, what's it? Oh, he said, I don't think you'd be interested. It's all junk. I said, could I look at you? So we went out and he'd pull his door open and, oh God, I saw all this stuff. And I said to him, boy, oh boy, would I like Mel? He said, there's plenty of it. He said, go help yourself. So I said, are you kidding? He said, no. So I came back home with my car full. And that's what you've got down there. And of course, in the meantime, I was in the process of getting a library of 5,500 Lincoln books. I was getting ready to donate to, now it's called Benedictine University, and it used to be a Bohemian school, Procopius, they used to call it, St. Procopius. And that was at Lyle, Illinois. You were, that's it. You were from Elmer. Well, you weren't, apparently you weren't from Elmer. It's late in your years. But Lyle is over near Naperville, Naperville, Illinois. It's back to the next stop on the Burlington. And they've got that Lincoln collection, and I worked about a year on that stuff, getting things all straightened out, the records. So I was always tired of it, tied up with something else besides medicine, which took most of my time. So that was one of the reasons that I really didn't get a chance to go through and get out of this what you've got there, which I wanted. But the next thing is that I had read so much, many times, about Fort Lewis and way back in the olden days with the Indians and so forth, and where they really had no real problem there because they didn't have a great Indian problem in that area. And I thought, well, I'd go to college down there. And so I just slept on that for a while. And that's when I finally made up my mind that I got in touch and wanted to know if they'd be interested in it. And, of course, they said yes. So that's how you got it. I thought it was 1967. Instead of 68 that I gave it to him, because I think, because that was the year that I started to, I'm pretty sure that's the year I started with Caterpillar. And when I moved my furnishing, we sent that stuff in and sent it, all that you've got there, sent that out to you in Colorado. I thought it was 67, but it probably was 68, because you've got records.
Huh. Well, it could be either way, huh? How did these records that you ended up with, that we ended up with, compare with the bulk of the records that were in those boxcars, you know? Well, I mean, were these the... how did you select these records, these particular ones, out of that whole mess of...
Walk through half a dozen to find out what they were about, roughly. Because I wasn't too sure when he might say, well, that's enough, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so when I would try to catch different times along through this thing, when I'd see something pertinent to the time element, why, I try to get enough out of that one area. But I was like a madman in that little boxcar. But there was an awful lot of stuff. I wish I had gotten more.
How much time did you get to spend with it?
Off and on there for about 3 days.
Huh.
I got to go in there. He never said anything. After that first one, he was getting that stuff already, and he was on the phone to not very far most of the time. And so I'd give him the high sign and go out and open the door in that boxcar. There was no lock on it. And I opened the door in the lock of the boxcar, and I used an awful lot of batteries. That was the only thing around, because I was in that thing. It was pretty high there. To get in, that stuff was really packed up. But my understanding was that was taken from the original building, RGS building, in Ridgeway. Downtown in Ridgeway, and they emptied all that stuff into, then there was a debate on whether they should burn it, right there, whether the city should burn it, or they tried to push it off onto everybody else. Nobody seemed to be interested except, well, a couple of these railroad fellows. Of course, Richardson was one. There was nobody around there, but Ed Brando, anytime I was there, well, he had individuals coming and going. They're friends that had been on the railroad and so forth and so on. And he'd introduce me to them, and that would be it. I would remember their name for 15 minutes afterwards.
Was the postmaster that you talked about earlier, was he still there?
postmaster, in fact, the postmaster was there